Chapter 20. Grand Central Station. All things are artificial, for nature is the art of God. From Thomas Brown on Dreams, Religio Medici, 1642. Angels need an assumed body, not for themselves, but on our account. From Thomas Aquinas, Summa Theologica, 151-2. The devil hath power to assume a pleasing shape. From Shakespeare's Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2, lines 6-8. The airlock was designed to accommodate only one person at a time. When questions of priority had come up, which nation would be first represented on the planet of another star, the five had thrown up their hands in disgust and told the project managers that this wasn't that kind of mission. They had conscientiously avoided discussing the issue among themselves. Both the interior and the exterior doors of the airlock opened simultaneously. They had given no command. Apparently, this sector of Grand Central was adequately pressurized and oxygenated. "Well, who wants to go first?" Devi asked. Video camera in hand, Ellie waited in line to exit, but then decided that the palm frond should be with her when she set foot on this new world, and she went to retrieve it. She heard a whoop of delight from outside, probably from Vega. Ellie rushed into the bright sunlight. The threshold of the airlock's exterior doorway was flush with the sand. Devi was ankle-deep in the water, playfully splashing in Shi's direction. Edda was smiling broadly. It was a beach. Waves were lapping on the sand. The blue sky sported a few lazy cumulus clouds. There was a stand of palm trees, irregularly spaced a little back from the water's edge. A sun was in the sky, one sun, a yellow one, just like ours, she thought. A faint aroma was in the air, cloves, perhaps, and cinnamon. It could have been a beach on Zanzibar. So, they had voyaged 30,000 light-years to walk on a beach. Could be worse, she thought. The breeze stirred, and a little whirlwind of sand was created before her. Was all this just some elaborate simulation of the Earth, perhaps reconstructed from the data returned by a routine scouting expedition millions of years earlier, or had the five of them undertaken this epic voyage only to improve their knowledge of descriptive astronomy, and then been unceremoniously dumped into some pleasant corner of the Earth? When she turned, she discovered that the dodecahedron had disappeared. They had left the superconducting supercomputer and its reference library, as well as some of the instruments aboard. It worried them for about a minute. They were safe, and they had survived a trip worth writing home about. Vega glanced from the frond that she had struggled to bring here to the colony of palm trees along the beach and laughed. "Calls to Newcastle," Devi commented. But her frond was different. Perhaps they had different species here, or maybe the local variety had been produced by an inattentive manufacturer. She looked out to sea. Irresistibly brought to mind was the image of the first colonization of the Earth's land some 400 million years ago. Wherever this was, the Indian Ocean or the centre of the galaxy, the five of them had done something unparalleled. The itinerary and destinations were entirely out of their hands, it was true, but they had crossed the ocean of interstellar space and begun what surely must be a new age in human history. She was very proud. She removed his boots and rolled up to his knees the legs of the tacky, insignia-laden jumpsuit that the governments had decreed they all must wear. He ambled through the gentle surf. Devi stepped behind a palm tree and emerged sari-clad, her jumpsuit draped over her arm. It reminded Ellie of a Dorothy L'Amour movie. Edda produced the sort of linen hat that was his usual trademark throughout the world. Ellie videotaped them in short, jumpy takes. It would look, when they got home, exactly like a home movie. She joined Chi and Vege in the water. The water seemed almost warm. It was a pleasant afternoon, and everything considered a welcome change from the Hokkaido winter that they had left little more than an hour before. "Everyone has brought something symbolic," said Vege, "except me." "How do you mean?" "Sukhavati and Edda bring national costumes. She here has brought a grain of rice." Indeed, she was holding the grain in a plastic bag between thumb and forefinger. "You have your palm frond," Vege continued, "but me, I have brought no symbols, no mementos from Earth. I'm the only real materialist in the group, and everything I have brought is in my head." Ellie had hung her medallion around her neck under the jumpsuit. Now she loosened the collar and pulled out the pendant. Vege noticed, and she gave it to him to read. "It's Plutarch, I think," he said after a moment. "Those were brave words the Spartans spoke, but remember, the Romans won the battle." From the tone of this admonition, Vege must have thought the medallion a gift from Dehir. She was warmed by his disapproval of Ken, surely justified by events, and by his steadfast solicitude. She took his arm. "I would kill for a cigarette," he said amiably, using his arm to squeeze her hand to his side. The five of them sat together by a little tide pool. The breaking of the surf generated a soft white noise that reminded her of Argus and her years of listening to cosmic static. The sun was well past the zenith over the ocean. A crab scuttled by, sidewise dexterous, its eyes swiveling on their stalks. With crabs, coconuts, and the limited provisions in their pockets, they could survive comfortably enough for some time. There were no footprints on the beach besides their own. "We think they did almost all of the work." Vege was explaining his and Ada's thinking on what the five of them had experienced. "All that the project did was to make the faintest pucker in space-time, so they would have something to hook their tunnel onto. In all of that multidimensional geometry, it must be very difficult to detect a tiny pucker in space-time, even harder to fit a nozzle onto it."
"But what are you saying? They changed the geometry of space?"
"Yes. We're saying that space is topologically non-simply connected. It's like... Now, I know Aboneba doesn't like this analogy. It's like a flat, two-dimensional surface. The smart surface connected by some maze of tubing with some other flat, two-dimensional surface. The dumb surface. The only way you can get from the smart surface to the dumb surface in a reasonable time is through the tubes. Now, imagine that the people on the smart surface lower a tube with a nozzle on it. They will make a tunnel between the two surfaces, provided the dumb ones cooperate by making a little pucker on their surface so the nozzle can attach itself. So the smart guys send a radio message and tell the dumb ones how to make a pucker. But if they're truly two-dimensional beings, how could they make a pucker on their surface? Well, by accumulating a great deal of mass in one place?" Vege said this tentatively. "But that's not what we did."
I know. Somehow the Benzels did it."
"You see," Ada explained softly, "if the tunnels are black holes, there are real contradictions implied. There is an interior tunnel in the exact Kerr solution of the Einstein field equations, but it's unstable. The slightest perturbation would seal it off and convert the tunnel into a physical singularity through which nothing can pass. I have tried to imagine a superior civilization that would control the internal structure of a collapsing star to keep the interior tunnel stable. Now, this is very difficult. The civilization would have to monitor and stabilize the tunnel forever. It would be especially difficult with something as large as the dodecahedron falling through.
But even if Abaneba can discover how to keep the tunnel open, there are many other problems, Vega said. Too many.
Black holes collect problems faster than they collect matter. They are the tidal forces. We should have been torn apart in the black hole's gravitational field. We should have been stretched like people in the paintings of El Greco or the sculptures of that Italian. He turned to Ellie to fill in the blank. Giacometti, she suggested. He was Swiss.
Yes, like Giacometti.
Then other problems. As measured from Earth, it takes an infinite amount of time for us to pass through a black hole, and we could never, never return to Earth.
Well, maybe this is what happened. Maybe we will never go home.
Then there should be an inferno of radiation near the singularity. Now, this is a quantum mechanical instability. And finally, Ada cut in and continued, a Kerr-type tunnel can lead to grotesque causality violations. With a modest change of trajectory inside the tunnel, one could emerge from the other end as early in the history of the universe as you might like. A picosecond after the Big Bang, for example. That would be a very disorderly universe.
Look, fellas, Ellie said, I'm no expert in general relativity, but didn't we see black holes? Didn't we fall into them? Didn't we emerge out of them? Now, isn't a gram of observation worth a ton of theory?
Oh, I know, Vega said in mild agony. It has to be something else. Our understanding of physics can't be so far off, can it?
He addressed this last question a little plaintively to Ada, who only replied,
A naturally occurring black hole can't be a tunnel. They have impossible singularities at their centers.
With a jerry-rigged sextant and their wristwatches, they timed the angular motion of the setting sun. It was 360 degrees in 24 hours, Earth standard. Before the sun got too low on the horizon, they disassembled Ellie's camera and used the lens to start a fire. She kept the frond by her side, fearful that someone would carelessly throw it on the flames after dark. She proved to be an expert firemaker. He positioned them upwind and kept the fire low. Gradually, the stars came out. They were all there, the familiar constellations of Earth. She volunteered to stay up a while, tending the fire while the others slept. She wanted to see Lyra rise. After some hours, it did. The night was exceptionally clear, and Vega shone steady and brilliant. From the apparent motion of the constellations across the sky, from the southern hemisphere constellations that she could make out, and from the Big Dipper lying near the northern horizon, she deduced that they were in tropical latitudes. If all this is a simulation, she thought before falling asleep, they've gone to a great deal of trouble. She had an odd little dream. The five of them were swimming, naked, unself-conscious, underwater. Now poised lazily near a staghorn coral, now gliding into crannies that for the next moment obscured by drifting seaweed. Once she rose to the surface, a ship in the shape of a dodecahedron flew by, low above the water. The walls were transparent, and inside she could see people in dhotis and sarongs reading newspapers and casually conversing. She dove back underwater, where she belonged. Although the dream seemed to go on for a long time, none of them had any difficulty breathing. They were inhaling and exhaling water. They felt no distress. Indeed, they were swimming as naturally as fish. Vega even looked a little like a fish, a grouper, perhaps. The water must be fiercely oxygenated, she supposed. In the middle of the dream, she remembered a mouse that she had once seen in a physiology laboratory, perfectly content in a flask of oxygenated water, even paddling, hopefully, with its little front feet.
A vermiform tail streamed behind. She tried to remember how much oxygen was needed, but it was too much trouble. She was thinking less and less, she thought. And that's all right, really. The others were now distinctly fish-like. Devi's fins were translucent. It was obscurely interesting, vaguely sensual. She hoped it would continue so she could figure something out. But even the question she wanted to answer eluded her. Oh, to breathe warm water, she thought. What will they think of next? Ellie awoke with a sense of disorientation so profound it bordered on vertigo. Where was she? Wisconsin? Puerto Rico? New Mexico? Wyoming? Hokkaido? Or the Strait of Malacca? And then she remembered. It was unclear to within 30,000 light years where in the Milky Way galaxy she was. Probably the all-time record for disorientation, she thought. Despite the headache, Ellie laughed, and Devi, sleeping beside her, stared. Because of the upward slope of the beach, they had reconnoitred out to a kilometre or so the previous afternoon and found not a hint of habitation. Direct sunlight had not yet reached her. Ellie was recumbent on a pillow of sand. Devi, just awakening, had slept with her head on the rolled-up jumpsuit. "Don't you think there's something can be asked about a culture that needs soft pillows?" Ellie asked. "The ones who put their heads in wooden yokes at night, now that's who the smart money's on." Devi laughed and wished her good morning. They could hear shouting from farther up the beach. The three men were waving and beckoning. Ellie and Devi roused themselves and joined them. Standing upright on the sand was a door. A wooden door with panelling and a brass doorknob. Anyway, it looked like brass. The door had black-painted metal hinges and was set in two jambs, a lintel and a threshold. No nameplate. It was in no way extraordinary for Earth. "Now go round the back," she invited. From the back, the door wasn't there at all. She could see Ada and Vege and she, Devi standing a little apart, and the sand continuous between the four of them and her. She moved to the side, the heels of her feet moistened by the surf, and she could make out a single, dark, razor-thin vertical line. She was reluctant to touch it. Returning to the back again, she satisfied herself that there were no shadows or reflections in the air before her, and then stepped through. "Bravo!" Ada laughed. She turned around and found the closed door before her. "What did you see?" she asked. "A lovely woman strolling through a closed door, 2 centimeters thick," he said. Vega seemed to be doing well, despite the dearth of cigarettes. "Have you tried opening the door?" she asked. "Not yet," she replied. She stepped back again, admiring the apparition. "It looks like something by... Oh, what's the name of that French surrealist?" Vega asked. "René Magritte," she answered. "He was Belgian." "We're agreed, I take it, that this isn't really the Earth," Devi proposed, her gesture encompassing ocean, beach, and sky. "Well, unless we're in the Persian Gulf 3,000 years ago, and there are genes about," Ellie laughed. "Aren't you oppressed by the care of the construction?" "All right," Ellie answered. "They're very good. I'll grant them that. But what's it for? Why go to the trouble of all this detail work? Maybe they just have a passion for getting things right. Or maybe they're just showing off." "Oh, I don't see," Devi continued, "how they could know our doors so well. Think of how many different ways there are to make a door. Now, how could they know?" "Oh, it could be television," Ellie responded. "Vega has received television signals from Earth up to, well, let's see, 1974 programming. Now, clearly they can send the interesting clips here by special delivery in no time flat. Probably there have been a lot of doors on television between 1936 and 1974. "Okay," she continued, as if there were not to change the subject. "What do we think would happen if we opened the door and walked
in. "If we are here to be tested," said she, "on the other side of that door is probably the test. Maybe one for each of us." He was ready. Ellie wished she were. The shadows of the nearest palms were now falling on the beach. Wordlessly they regarded one another. All four of them seemed eager to open the door and step through. She alone felt some reluctance. She asked Edda if he would like to go first. "We might as well put our best foot forward," she thought. He doffed his cap, made a slight but graceful bow, turned, and approached the door. Ellie ran to him and kissed him on both cheeks. The others embraced him also. He turned again, opened the door, entered, and disappeared into thin air, his striding foot first, his trailing hand last. With the door ajar, there had seemed to be only the continuation of beach and surf behind him. The door closed. She ran around it, but there was no trace of Edda. She was next. Ellie found herself struck by how docile they had all been, instantly obliging every anonymous invitation proffered. They could have told us where they were taking us and what all this was for, she thought. It could have been part of the message or information conveyed after the machine was activated. They could have told us we were docking with a simulation or a beach on Earth. They could have told us to expect the door. True, as accomplished as they are, the extraterrestrials might know English imperfectly. With television as their only tutor, their knowledge of Russian, Mandarin, Tamil, and Hausa would be even more rudimentary. But they had invented the language introduced in the message primer. Why not use it to retain the element of surprise, she thought. Vege saw her staring at the closed door and asked if she wished to enter next. "Oh, thanks, Vege, I've been thinking. I know it's a little crazy, but it just struck me, why do we have to jump through every hoop they hold out for us? Now, suppose we don't do what they ask." "Oh, Ellie, you're so American. For me, this is just like home. I'm used to doing what the authorities suggest, especially when I have no choice." He smiled and turned smartly on his heel. "Well, don't take any crap from the Grand Duke," she called after him. High above, a gull squawked. Vege had left the door ajar. There was still only beach beyond. "Are you all right?" Devi asked her. "Oh, I'm okay, really. I just want a moment to myself. I'll be along." "No, seriously, I'm asking as a doctor. Do you feel all right?" "Well, I woke up with a headache, and I think I had some very fanciful dreams. I haven't brushed my teeth or had my black coffee. I wouldn't mind reading the morning paper either, except for all that. Really, I'm fine." "Well, that sounds all right. For that matter, I have a bit of a headache, too. Now, take care of yourself, Ellie. Remember everything so you'll be able to tell it to me next time we meet." "I will," Ellie promised. They kissed and wished each other well. Devi stepped over the threshold and vanished. The door closed behind her. Afterward, Ellie thought that she'd caught a whiff of curry. She brushed her teeth in salt water. A certain fastidious streak had always been a part of her nature. She breakfasted it on coconut milk. Carefully, she brushed accumulated sand off the exterior surfaces of the micro-camera system and its tiny arsenal of video cassettes on which she had recorded wonders. She washed the palm frond in the surf, as she had done the day she found it on Cocoa Beach, just before the launch up to Methuselah. The morning was already warm, and she decided to take a swim. Her clothes carefully folded on the palm frond, she strode boldly out into the surf. Whatever else, she thought, the extraterrestrials are unlikely to find themselves aroused by the sight of a naked woman, even if she is pretty well preserved. She tried to imagine a microbiologist stirred to crimes of passion after viewing a paramecium caught in flagrante delicto in mitosis.
Languidly she floated on her back, bobbing up and down, her slow rhythm in phase with the arrival of successive wave crests. She tried to imagine thousands of comparable chambers, simulated worlds, whatever these were, each a meticulous copy of the nicest part of someone's home planet. Thousands of them. Each with sky and weather, ocean, geology, indigenous life, indistinguishable from the originals. It seemed an extravagance, although it also suggested that a satisfactory outcome was within reach. No matter what your resources, you don't manufacture a landscape on this scale for five specimens from a doomed world. On the other hand, the idea of extraterrestrials as zookeepers had become something of a cliché. What if this sizable station, with its profusion of docking ports and environments, was actually a zoo? See the exotic animals in their native habitats, she imagined some snail-headed barker shouting. Tourists come from all over the galaxy, especially during school vacations, and then, when there's a test, the station masters temporarily move the critters and the tourists out, sweep the beach, free of footprints, give the newly arriving primitives a half day of rest and recreation before the test ordeal begins. Or maybe this was how they stocked the zoos. She thought about the animals locked away in terrestrial zoos, who were said to have experienced difficulties breeding in captivity. Somersaulting in the water, she dived beneath the surface in a moment of self-consciousness. She took a few strong strokes in towards the beach, and for the second time in 24 hours wished that she had had a baby. There was no one about, and not a sail on the horizon. A few seagulls were stalking the beach, apparently looking for crabs. She wished she'd brought some bread to give them. After she was dry, she dressed and inspected the doorway again. It was merely waiting. She felt a continuing reluctance to enter. More than reluctance, maybe dread. She withdrew, keeping it in view. Beneath a palm tree, her knees drawn up under her chin, she looked out over the long sweep of white, sandy beach. After a while, she got up and stretched a little. Carrying the frond and the micro-camera with one hand, she approached the door and turned the knob. It opened, slightly. Through the crack, she could see the white caps offshore. She gave it another push, and it swung open without a squeak. The beach. Bland and disinterested, stared back at her. She shook her head and returned to the tree, resuming her pensive posture. She wondered about the others. Were they now in some outlandish testing facility, avidly checking away on the multiple-choice questions, or was it an oral examination? And who were the examiners? She felt the uneasiness well up once again. Another intelligent being, independently evolved on some distant world, under unearthly physical conditions, and with an entirely different sequence of random genetic mutations. Such a being would not resemble anyone she knew, or even imagined. If this was a test station, then there were station masters, and the station masters would be thoroughly, devastatingly non-human. There was something deep within her that was bothered by insects, snakes, star-nosed moles. She was someone who felt a little shudder, to speak plainly, a tremor of loathing when confronted with even slightly malformed human beings, cripples, children with Down syndrome, even the appearance of Parkinsonism evoked in her, against her clear intellectual resolve, a feeling of disgust, a wish to flee. Generally, she had been able to contain her fear, although she wondered if she had ever hurt someone because of it. It wasn't something she thought about much. She would sense her own embarrassment and move on to another topic. But now she worried that she would be unable even to confront, much less to win over, for the human species, an extraterrestrial being. They hadn't thought to screen the five for that.
There had been no effort to determine whether they were afraid of mice or dwarves or Martians. It had simply not occurred to the examining committees. She wondered why they hadn't thought of it. It seemed an obvious enough point now. It had been a mistake to send her. Perhaps when confronted with some serpent-haired galactic station master, she would disgrace herself, or, far worse, tip the grade given to the human species in whatever unfathomable test was being administered, from pass to fail. She looked with both apprehension and longing at the enigmatic door. Its lower boundary now underwater. The tide was coming in. There was a figure on the beach a few hundred meters away. At first she thought it was Vega, perhaps out of the examining room early and come to tell her the good news. But whoever it was wasn't wearing a machine project jumpsuit. Also, it seemed to be someone younger, more vigorous. She reached for the long lens and for some reason hesitated. Standing up, she shielded her eyes from the sun. Just for a moment, it had seemed. It was clearly impossible. They would not take such shameless advantage of her. But she could not help herself. She was racing towards him on the hard sand near the water's edge, her hair streaming behind her. He looked as he had in the most recent picture of him that she'd seen, vigorous, happy. He had a day's growth of beard. She flew into his arms, sobbing. "Hello, Presh," he said, his right hand stroking the back of her head. His voice was right. She instantly remembered it, and his smell, his gait, his laugh, the way his beard abraded her cheek, all of it combined to shatter her self-possession. She could feel a massive stone seal being pried open and the first rays of light entering an ancient, almost forgotten tomb. She swallowed and tried to gain control of herself, but seemingly inexhaustible waves of anguish poured out of her, and she would weep again. He stood there, patiently, reassuring her with the same look she now remembered that he'd given her from his post at the bottom of the staircase during her first solo journey down the big steps. More than anything else, she had longed to see him again. But she had suppressed the feeling, been impatient with it, because it was so clearly impossible to fulfill. She cried for all the years between herself and him. In her girlhood, and as a young woman, she would dream that he had come to her to tell her that his death had been a mistake. He was really fine. He would sweep her up into his arms. But she would pay for those brief respites with poignant reawakenings into a world in which he no longer was. Still, she had cherished those dreams, and willingly paid their exorbitant tariff when the next morning she was forced to rediscover her loss and experience the agony again. Those phantom moments were all that she had left of him. And now here he was, not a dream or a ghost, but flesh and blood, or close enough. He had called to her from the stars, and she had come. She hugged him with all her might. She knew it was a trick, a reconstruction, a simulation, but it was flawless. For a moment she held him by the shoulders at arm's length. He was perfect. It was as if her father had these many years ago died and gone to heaven, and finally, by this unorthodox route, she had managed to rejoin him. She sobbed and embraced him again. It took her another minute to compose herself. If it had been Ken, say, she would have at least toyed with the idea that another dodecahedron, maybe a repaired Soviet machine, had made a later relay from the Earth to the centre of the galaxy, but not for a moment could such a possibility be entertained for him. His remains were decaying in a cemetery by a lake. She wiped her eyes, laughing and crying at once. "So, what do I owe this apparition to, robotics or hypnosis? Am I an artifact or a dream? You might ask that about anything. Even today, Not a week goes by when I don't think that I'd give anything I had, just to spend a few minutes with my father again.
"Well, here I am," he said cheerfully, his hands raised, making a half turn,
so she could be sure that the back of him was there as well. He was so young, younger surely than she. He had been only 36 when he died. Maybe this was their way of calming her fears. If so, they were very thoughtful. She guided him back towards her few possessions, her arm around his waist. He certainly felt substantial enough. If there were gear trains and integrated circuits underneath his skin, they were well hidden.
"So, how are we doing?" she asked. The question was ambiguous. "I mean, I know.
It took you many years from receipt of the message to your arrival here.
Do you grade on speed or accuracy?"
"Neither."
"You mean we haven't completed the test yet?"
He did not answer.
"Well, explain it to me."
She said this in some distress.
"Some of us have spent years decrypting the message and building the machine. Aren't you going to tell me what it's all about?"
"You've become a real scrapper," he said, as if he really were her father, as if he were comparing his last recollections of her with her present, still incompletely developed self. He gave her hair an affectionate tousle. She remembered that from childhood also, but how could they, 30,000 light-years from Earth, know her father's affectionate gestures in long-ago and far-away Wisconsin? Suddenly she knew.
"Dreams," she said. "Last night, when we were all dreaming, you were inside our heads, right? You drained everything we know, or we only made copies," he said.
"I think everything that used to be in your head is still there. Take a look. Tell me if anything's missing." He grinned and went on.
"There was so much your television programs didn't tell us. Oh, we could figure out your technological level pretty well and a lot more about you, but there's so much more to your species than that. Things we couldn't possibly learn indirectly. I recognize you may feel some breach of privacy."
"You're joking, but we have so little time."
"You mean the test is over? We answered all your questions while we were asleep last night. So, did we pass or fail?"
"It isn't like that," he said. "It isn't like sixth grade." She had been in the sixth grade the year he died. He went on,
"Don't think of us as some interstellar sheriff gunning down outlaw civilizations. Think of us more as the office of the galactic census. We collect information. I know you think nobody has any to learn from you because you're technologically so far backward, but there are other merits to a civilization."
"What merits?" she said. "Oh, music. Loving kindness. I like that word. Dreams. Humans are very good at dreaming, although you'd never know it from your television. There are cultures all over the galaxy that trade dreams."
"You operate an interstellar cultural exchange," she said. "That's what all this is about. You don't care if some rapacious, bloodthirsty civilization develops interstellar spaceflight."
"I said, we admire loving kindness."
She went on, "If the Nazis had taken over the world, our world, and then developed interstellar spaceflight, wouldn't you have stepped in?"
"Oh, you'd be surprised how rarely something like that happens. In the long run, the aggressive civilizations destroy themselves almost always. It's their nature. They can't help it. In such a case, our job would be to leave them alone, to make sure that no one bothers them, to let them work out their destiny."
"Then why didn't you leave us alone?" said Ellie. "Oh, I'm not complaining, mind you. I'm only curious as to how the office of the Galactic Census works. The first thing you picked up from us was that Hitler broadcast. Now, why did you make contact?"
"The picture, of course, was alarming," he said. "We could tell you were in deep trouble, but the music told us something else. The Beethoven told us there was hope. Marginal cases are our speciality. We thought you could use a little help. Now, really, we can offer only a little. You understand? There are certain limitations imposed by causality."
He had crouched down, running his hands through the water, and was now drying them on his pants. "Last night we looked inside you, all five of you. There's a lot in there. Feelings, memories, instincts, learned behavior, insights, madness, dreams and loves. Love is very important. You're an interesting mix. All that in one night's work," she said. She was taunting him a little. "Oh, we had to hurry. We have a pretty tight schedule." "Why? Is something about it?" "No," he answered. "It's just that if we don't engineer a consistent causality, it'll work itself out on its own. Then it's almost always worse." She had no idea what he meant. "Engineer a consistent causality?" she repeated. "My dad never used to talk like that." "Oh, certainly he did. Don't you remember how he spoke to you? He was a well-read man, and from when you were a little girl, I talked to you as an equal. Don't you remember?" She remembered. She remembered. She thought of her mother in the nursing home. "What a nice pendant," he said, with just that air of fatherly reserve she had always imagined he would have cultivated had he lived to see her adolescence. "Who gave it to you?" "Oh, this," she said, fingering the medallion. "Actually, it's from somebody I don't know very well. He tested my faith. But you must know all this already." Again, the grin. "I want to know what you think of us," she said shortly. "What you really think." He did not hesitate for a moment. "All right. I think it's amazing that you've done as well as you have. You've got hardly any theory of social organization. Astonishingly backward economic systems. No grasp of the machinery of historical prediction and very little knowledge about yourselves. Considering how fast your world is changing, it's amazing you haven't blown yourselves to bits by now. That's why we don't want to write you off just yet. You humans have a certain talent for adaptability, at least in the short term. And that's the issue, isn't it? That's one issue. You can see that after a while, the civilizations with only short-term perspectives just aren't around. They work out their destinies also." She wanted to ask him how he honestly felt about humans. Curiosity. Compassion. No feelings whatever, just all in a day's work. In his heart of hearts, or whatever equivalent internal organs he possessed, did he think of her as she thought of an ant? But she could not bring herself to raise the question. She was too much afraid of the answer. From the intonation of his voice, from the nuances of his speech, she tried to gain some glimpse of who it was here, disguised as her father. She had an enormous amount of direct experience with human beings. The station masters had less than a day's. Could she not discern something of their true nature beneath this amiable and informative facade? But she couldn't. In the content of his speech, he was, of course, not her father, nor did he pretend to be, but in every other respect he was uncannily close to Theodore F. Arroway, 1924-1960, vendor of hardware, loving husband and father. If not for a continuous effort of will, she knew she would be slobbering over this copy. Part of her kept wanting to ask him how things had been since he'd gone to heaven. What were his views on Advent and Rapture? Was anything special in the works for the millennium? There were human cultures that taught an afterlife of the blessed on mountaintops or in clouds, in caverns or oases, but she could not recall any in which, if you were very, very good, when you died, you went to the beach. "Do we have time for some questions before, well, whatever it is we have to do next?" "Oh, sure," he said. "One or two, anyway. Tell me about your transportation system." "I can do better than that," he said. "I can show you. Steady now." An amoeba of blackness leaked out from the zenith, obscuring sun and blue sky. "That's quite a trick," she gasped. The same sandy beach was beneath her feet. She dug her toes in. Overhead was the cosmos. They were, it seemed, high above the Milky Way galaxy, looking down on its spiral structure and falling toward it at some impossible speed. He explained matter-of-factly, using her own familiar scientific language to describe the vast pinwheel-shaped structure. He showed her the Orion spiral arm, in which the sun was, in this epoch, embedded. Interior to it, in decreasing order of mythological significance, were the Sagittarius arm, the Norma Scutum arm, and the three kiloparsec arm. A network of straight lines appeared, representing the transportation system that they had used. It was like the illuminated maps of the Paris Metro. Ada had been right. Each station she deduced was in a star system with a low-mass double black hole. She knew the black holes couldn't have resulted from stellar collapse, from the normal evolution of massive star systems, because they were too small. Maybe they were primordial, left over from the Big Bang, captured by some unimaginable starship and towed to their designated station. Or maybe they were made from scratch. She wanted to ask about this, but the tour was pressing breathlessly onward. There was a disk of glowing hydrogen rotating about the center of the galaxy, and within it a ring of molecular clouds rushing outward toward the periphery of the Milky Way. He showed her the ordered motions in the giant molecular cloud complex Sagittarius B2, which had for decades been a favorite hunting ground for complex organic molecules by her radio-astronomical colleagues on Earth. Closer to the center, they encountered another giant molecular cloud, and then Sagittarius A West, an intense radio source that Ellie herself had observed at Argus. And just adjacent, at the very center of the galaxy, locked in a passionate gravitational embrace, was a pair of immense black holes. The mass of one of these black holes was 5 million suns. Rivers of gas, the size of solar systems, were pouring down its maw. Too colossal, she ruminated on the limitations of the languages of Earth, two supermassive black holes are orbiting one another at the center of the galaxy. One had been known, or at least strongly suspected, but two. Well, shouldn't that have shown up as a Doppler displacement of spectral lines? She imagined a sign under one of them reading entrance and under the other exit. At the moment, the entrance was in use. The exit was merely there. And that was where this station, Grand Central Station, was, just safely outside the black holes at the center of the galaxy. The skies were made brilliant by millions of nearby young stars, but the stars, the gas and the dust, were being eaten up by the entrance black hole. "It goes somewhere, right?" she asked. "Of course." "Well, can you tell me where?" "Oh, sure. All this stuff winds up in Cygnus A." Cygnus A was something she knew about, except only for a nearby supernova remnant in Cassiopeia. It was the brightest radio source in the skies of Earth. She had calculated that in 1 second Cygnus A produces more energy than the sun does in 40,000 years. The radio source was 600 million light-years away, far beyond the Milky Way, out in the realm of the galaxies. As with many extragalactic radio sources, two enormous jets of gas, fleeing apart at almost the speed of light, were making a complex web of Rankine-Hugoniot shock fronts with the thin intergalactic gas, and producing in the process a radio beacon that shone brightly over most of the universe. All the matter in this enormous structure, 500,000 light-years across, was pouring out of a tiny, almost inconspicuous point in space, exactly midway between the jets. "You're making Cygnus A?" she said. She half remembered a summer's night in Michigan when she was a girl. She had feared that she would fall into the sky. "Oh, it's not just us. This is a cooperative project of many galaxies. That's what we mainly do, engineering. Only a few of us are involved with emerging civilizations." At each pause, she felt a kind of tingling in her head, approximately in the left parietal lobe. "There are cooperative projects between galaxies?" she asked.
Lots of galaxies, each with a kind of central administration, with hundreds of billions of stars in each galaxy, and then those administrations cooperate to pour millions of suns into Centaurus. I'm sorry, Cygnus A. They... Oh, forgive me. I'm just staggered by the scale. Why would you do all this, whatever for?
You mustn't think of the universe as a wilderness, he said. It hasn't been that for billions of years. Think of it more as cultivated.
Again, that tingling in her head. She said, but what for? What's there to cultivate?
The basic problem is easily stated. Now, don't get scared off by the scale. You're an astronomer, after all. The problem is that the universe is expanding and there's not enough matter in it to stop the expansion. After a while, no new galaxies, no new stars, no new planets, no newly arisen life forms, just the same old crowd. Everything's getting run down. It'll be boring. So, in Cygnus A, we're testing out the technology to make something new. You might call it an experiment in urban renewal. It's not our only trial run. Sometime later, we might want to close off a piece of the universe and prevent space from getting more and more empty as the aeons pass. Increasing the local matter density is the way to do it, of course. It's good, honest work. Like running a hardware store in Wisconsin. If Cygnus A was 600 million light years away, then astronomers on Earth, or anywhere in the Milky Way for that matter, were seeing it as it had been 600 million years ago. But on Earth, 600 million years ago, she knew there'd hardly been any life, except in the oceans, big enough to shake a stick at. Oh God, they were old. 600 million years ago, on a beach like this one, except no crabs, no girls, no palm trees. She tried to imagine some microscopic plant washed ashore, securing a tremulous toehold just above the waterline, while these beings were occupied with experimental galactogenesis and introductory cosmic engineering. She said, you've been pouring matter into Cygnus A for the last 600 million years.
Well, what you've detected by radio astronomy was just some of our early feasibility testing. We're much further along now.
And in due course. In another few hundred million years, she imagined, radio astronomers on Earth, if any, will detect substantial progress in the reconstruction of the universe around Cygnus A. She steeled herself for further revelations and vowed she would not let them intimidate her. There was a hierarchy of beings on a scale she had not imagined. But the Earth had a place, a significance in that hierarchy. They would not have gone to all this trouble for nothing. The blackness rushed back to the zenith and was consumed. Sun and blue sky returned. The scene was the same. Surf, sand, palms, Magritte d'Or, microcamera frond, and her father. Those moving interstellar clouds, she said, and rings near the center of the galaxy, aren't they due to periodic explosions around here? Isn't it dangerous to locate the station here? Oh, episodic, not periodic. It only happens on a small scale, nothing like the sort of thing we're doing in Cygnus A, and it's manageable. We know when it's coming, and we generally just hunker down. If it's really dangerous, we take the station somewhere else for a while. This is all routine, you understand? Oh, of course, routine. You built it all, the subways, I mean. You and those other engineers from other galaxies.
Oh, no. We haven't built any of it.
I've missed something. I must have. Help me understand.
Well, it seems to be the same everywhere. In our case, we emerged a long time ago on many different worlds in the Milky Way. The first of us developed interstellar spaceflight and eventually chanced on one of those transit stations. Of course, we didn't know what it was. We weren't even sure it was artificial until the first of us were brave enough to slide down it.
Who's we? You mean the ancestors of your race, your species?
Oh, no, no. We're many species from many worlds. Eventually, we found a large number of subways, various ages, various styles of ornamentation, and all abandoned. Most were still in good working condition. All we did was make some repairs and improvements.
No other artifacts, no dead cities, no records of what happened, no subway builders left.
He shook his head.
No industrialized, abandoned planets.
He repeated the gesture.
You mean there was a galaxy-wide civilization that picked up and left without leaving a trace, except for the stations?
He said, that's more or less right. And it's the same in other galaxies also. Billions of years ago, they all went somewhere. We haven't the slightest idea where.
But where could they go?
She asked.
He shook his head for the third time, but now, very slowly. She said, so then, you're not...
No, he said. We're just caretakers. Maybe someday they'll come back.
Okay, just one more, she pleaded, holding her index finger up before her, as probably had been her practice at age two. One more question, please.
All right, he answered tolerantly. But we only have a few minutes left.
She glanced at the doorway again and suppressed a tremor as a small, almost transparent crab sidled by. I want to know about your myths, your religions. What fills you with awe? Or are those who make the numinous unable to feel it?
You make the numinous also. No, I know what you're asking. Now, certainly we feel it. You recognize that some of this is hard for me to communicate to you, but I'll give you an example of what you're asking for. I don't say this is it exactly, but I'll give you a...
He paused momentarily, and again she felt a tingle, this time in her left occipital lobe. She entertained the notion that he was rifling through her neurons. Had he missed something last night? If so, she was glad. It meant they weren't perfect.
Flavor of our numinous. I'll give you a flavor of our numinous. It concerns pi. The ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter. You know it well, of course, and you also know you can never come to the end of pi. There's no creature in the universe, no matter how smart, who could calculate pi to the last digit. Because there is no last digit. Only an infinite number of digits. Your mathematicians have made an effort to calculate it out, too.
Again, she felt the tingle.
None of you seem to know. Let's say the 10 billionth place. You won't be surprised to hear that other mathematicians have gone further. Well, eventually, let's say it's in the 10 to the 20th power place. Something happens. The randomly varying digits disappear, and for an unbelievably long time, there's nothing but ones and zeros.
Idly, he was tracing a circle out on the sand with his toe. She paused a heartbeat before replying. And the zeros and ones finally stop? You get back to a random sequence of digits? Seeing a faint sign of encouragement from him, she raced on. And the number of zeros and ones, is it a product of prime numbers?
Yes, 11 of them.
You're telling me there's a message in 11 dimensions, hidden deep inside the number pi. Someone in the universe communicates by mathematics? But, oh, help me, I'm really having trouble understanding you. Mathematics isn't arbitrary. I mean, pi has to have the same value everywhere. How can you hide a message inside pi? It's built into the fabric of the universe.
Exactly.
She stared at him.
It's even better than that, he continued. Let's assume that only in base 10 arithmetic does the sequence of zeros and ones show up, although you'd recognize that something funny is going on in any other arithmetic. Let's also assume that the beings who first made this discovery had 10 fingers. Now, you see how it looks. It's as if pi has been waiting for billions of years for 10-fingered mathematicians with fast computers to come along. You see? The message was kind of addressed to us. But this is just a metaphor, right? She said. It's not really pi and the 10 to the 20th place. You don't actually have 10 fingers. Not really, he said. He smiled at her again. Well, for heaven's sake, what does the message say? He paused for a moment, raised an index finger, and then pointed to the door. A small crowd of people was excitedly pouring out of it. They were in a jovial mood, as if this were a long-delayed picnic outing. Edo was accompanying a stunning young woman in a brightly coloured blouse and skirt, her hair neatly covered with the lacy gilet favoured by Muslim women in Yorubaland. He was clearly overjoyed to see her. From photographs he had shown, Ellie recognized her as Edda's wife. Sukhavati was holding hands with an earnest young man, his eyes large and soulful. She assumed it was Surinder Ghosh, Devi's long-dead medical student husband. She was in animated discourse with a small, vigorous man of commanding demeanor. He had drooping, wispy moustaches and was garbed in a richly brocaded and beaded gown. Ellie imagined him personally overseeing the construction of the funerary model of the Middle Kingdom, shouting instructions to those who poured the mercury. Vege ushered over a girl of 11 or 12, her blonde braids bobbing as she walked. "This is my granddaughter, Nina, more or less. My grand duchess. I should have introduced you before, in Moscow." Ellie embraced the girl. She was relieved that Vege had not appeared with Mira, the ecdysiast. Ellie observed his tenderness towards Nina and decided she liked him more than ever. Over all the years that she'd known him, he had kept this secret place within his heart, well hidden. "I have not been a good father to her mother," he confided. "These days I hardly see Nina at all." She looked around her. The station masters had produced for each of the five what could only be described as their deepest loves. Perhaps it was only to ease the barriers of communication with another appallingly different species. She was glad that none of them were happily chatting with an exact copy of themselves. "What if you could do this back on Earth?" she wondered. "What if, despite all our pretense and disguise, it was necessary to appear in public with the person we loved most of all? Imagine this a prerequisite for social discourse on Earth. It would change everything." She imagined a phalanx of members of one sex surrounding a solitary member of the other, or chains of people, circles, the letters H or Q, lazy figure eights. You could monitor deep affections at a glance just by looking at the geometry, a kind of general relativity applied to social psychology. The practical difficulties of such an arrangement would be considerable, but no one would be able to lie about love. The caretakers were in a polite but determined hurry. There was not much time to talk. The entrance to the airlock of the dodecahedron was now visible, roughly where it had been when they first arrived. By symmetry, or perhaps because of some interdimensional conservation law, the Magritte doorway had vanished. They introduced everyone. She felt silly, in more ways than one, explaining in English to the Emperor Qin who her father was. But she dutifully translated, and they all solemnly shook hands, as if this were their first encounter, perhaps at a suburban barbecue. Edda's wife was a considerable beauty, and Surinder Ghosh was giving her a more than casual inspection. Devi did not seem to mind. Perhaps she was merely gratified at the accuracy of the imposture. "Where did you go when you stepped through the doorway?" Ellie softly asked her. 416 Maiden Hall Way," she answered. Ellie looked at her blankly. "London, 1973, with Surinder.
She nodded her head in his direction. Before he died. Ellie wondered what she would have found had she crossed that threshold on the beach. Wisconsin in the late 50s, probably. She hadn't shown up on schedule, so he had come to find her. He had done that in Wisconsin more than once. Edda had also been told about a message deep inside a transcendental number, but in his story it was not pi, or e, the base of natural logarithms, but a class of numbers she'd never heard of. With an infinity of transcendental numbers, they would never know for sure which number to examine back on Earth. "I hungered to stay and work on it," he told Ellie softly. "And I sensed they needed help. Some way of thinking about the decipherment that hadn't occurred to them. But I think it's something very personal for them. They don't want to share it with others, and realistically, I suppose, we just aren't smart enough to give them a hand." They hadn't decrypted the message in Pi. The station masters, the caretakers, the designers of new galaxies hadn't figured out a message that had been sitting under their thumbs for a galactic rotation or two. Well, was the message that difficult, or were they... "Time to go home," her father said it gently. It was wrenching. She didn't want to go. She tried staring at the palm frond. She tried asking more questions. "How do you mean, go home? You mean we're going to emerge somewhere in the solar system? How will we get back down to Earth?" "You'll see," he answered. "It'll be interesting." He put his arm around her waist, guiding her toward the open airlock door. It was like bedtime. You could be cute, you could ask bright questions, and maybe they'd let you stay up a little later. It used to work. At least a little. "The Earth is linked up now, right, both ways? I mean, if we can go home, you can come down to us in a jiffy. You know, that makes me awfully nervous. Why don't you just sever the link? We'll take it from here." "Sorry, Presh," he replied, as if she had already shamelessly prolonged her 8 o'clock bedtime. Was he sorry about bedtime, or about being unready to de-nozzle the tunnel? "For a while, at least, it'll be open only to inbound traffic," he said. "But we don't expect to use it." She liked the isolation of the Earth from Vega. She preferred a 52-year-long leeway between unacceptable behavior on Earth and the arrival of a punitive expedition. The black hole link was uncomfortable. They could arrive almost instantaneously, perhaps only in Hokkaido or perhaps anywhere on Earth. It was a transition to what Haddon had called micro-intervention. No matter what assurances they gave, they would watch us more closely now. No more dropping in for a casual look-see every few million years. She explored her discomfort further. How theological the circumstances had become. Here were beings who lived in the sky, beings enormously knowledgeable and powerful, beings concerned for our survival, beings with a set of expectations about how we should behave. They disclaimed such a role, but they could clearly visit reward and punishment, life and death on the puny inhabitants of Earth. Now, how is this different, she asked herself, from the old-time religion? The answer occurred to her instantly. It was a matter of evidence. In her videotapes, in the data the others had acquired, there would be hard evidence of the existence of the station, of what went on here, of the black hole transit system. There would be 5 independent, mutually corroborative stories, supported by compelling physical evidence. This one was fact, not hearsay and hocus-pocus. She turned toward him and dropped the frond. Wordlessly, he stooped and returned it to her. "You've been very generous in answering all my questions. Can I answer any for you?" "Oh, thanks, but you answered all our questions last night." "Well, that's it," she said. "No commandments, no instructions for the provincials.
It doesn't work that way, Presh. You've grown up now. You're on your own. He tilted his head, gave her that grin, and she flew into his arms, her eyes again filling with tears. It was a long embrace. Eventually, she felt him gently disengage her arms. It was time to go up to bed. She imagined holding up her index finger and asking for still one more minute. But she did not want to disappoint him. "Bye, Presh," he said. "Give your mother my love." "Take care," she replied in a small voice. She took one last look at the seashore, at the center of the galaxy. A pair of seabirds, petrels perhaps, were suspended on some rising column of air. They remained aloft with hardly a beat of their wings. Just at the entrance to the airlock, she turned and called to him. "What does your message say, the one in pi?" "We don't know," he replied a little sadly, taking a few steps towards her. "Maybe it's a kind of statistical accident. We're still working on it." The breeze stirred up, tousling her hair once again. "Well, give us a call when you figure it out," she said.